Zero body count.
We'll see.
Welcome to Franchise Fan Guys, where this is our fourth part talking about the Mission Impossible franchise. I'm Tom Breifogel, joined by Andy Schmidt and Skid Marr. Why don't you guys introduce yourselves? Andy?
Hi, I'm Andy.
Oh, hi, I didn't see you there. I'm Skid. And here's another Mission Impossible. All right, that's it. I'm giving up the bit. That's it. It's just too much pressure. I can't do it anymore.
Totally understand. Franchise Fan Guys. When, if ever, did you start to enjoy the characters of this franchise? Was there a point for you when Luther or Ethan or any of the others struck you as people you wanted to see again? Which characters are they, and when did they click for you? How important are any of these characters to the franchise itself, now or going forward? What do you think, Skid?
I think, for me, a big factor in movies like this is the actors and the way that they bring in sort of the weight of their other projects that they've done into this new thing, even if they're unconnected. So, like, when Mission Impossible, the first one, came out, Jean Reno was just coming off The Professional, right?
Relatively recently, yeah.
Yeah, pretty, yeah. So, but I know, like, Jean Reno was even more than the States, like, he was pretty well known, but internationally, he was massively huge. I was in Japan that right around this time, and he was the biggest international star in Japan. So he had this kind of draw to him. And then Ving Rhames is coming off the last thing I remember seeing him in was, you know, Pulp Fiction. Like, that was his big starring role. That was the year before. And so that, for me, I was automatically sort of riveted to these characters just because these actors had so recently made such a big impact in a pop culture sense. But I didn't really become invested in the characters until 3. And for me, like I said before, like, it was really Simon Pegg. Like, Simon Pegg is someone that I just have such fondness for. And that character is so great. Just having that sort of everyman who still is, you know, a legitimate reason to be on this impossible mission force. Having that sort of hook as kind of an entry point to really start caring about these people. And yeah, from that point on, they become more personal, and then I became more invested in the characters themselves.
Tom, what do you think? Because you were really the newest to the franchise. What did you think?
My thoughts were pretty similar. Well, I've always liked that Luther, especially as the movies go on, is like someone who knows Ethan better than anyone else. But until they started reappearing, I really wasn't looking forward to seeing the characters in every movie. I just felt like they were going to be replaced every movie. Once it started to be more of a team setting, it coincides with when the movies start getting better. I don't know if that's why. Maybe it's a reason why. But like overall, I still think they could continue on without Benji and Luther and pull it off. But I would rather them not. But yeah, Ethan himself, I don't relate to Ethan really at all. I don't know. I guess he has to be in it because he is the star.
But I guess he has to be in
no way. In no way am I like, all right, what's my boy Ethan up to this year? Like, yeah, I guess he has to be in it unless. Yeah, has there been a movie franchise where they change the star and it works after 6 movies?
James Bond. James Bond is the. Yeah, that would be the one. And I mean,
but it's still James Bond. I mean, to change it so it's not Ethan Hunt.
Yeah, well, and similar to James Bond, they've changed the actor playing Jack Ryan a whole bunch of times.
Yeah.
And those movies don't make a whole lot of sense together. Those are all kind of made as single movies that sort of have a character throughout, but they don't like flow from one to the next.
They're sort of like a series of reboots.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Which is, that's the argument that my brother and I get into about the Fox X-Men franchise. It's like, he always wants the continuity to work. And he's like, what? You know, but it works. Would you like to do that? I'm like, stop. Just stop. No one making these movies cares about continuity. That's you. Don't put that on those movies. Anyway. Yeah, the one place that just came to mind, probably because it's a relatively similar sort of franchise, is the Bourne Legacy, when they tried to have Jeremy Renner as a different character take over the Bourne franchise. It did not work. There are some, you know, certainly in television shows you've seen that, where like a lead actor, you know, their character leaves, you know, after a season or two or something. You know, I've seen it in television. I've not seen it as much in a film franchise. Can either of you think of any?
I guess I haven't seen the season, but I know there was a season of The Office without Steve Carell.
I did not know that. I've never watched The Office.
Yeah,
that's a thing I'm not supposed to admit to as a person in the entertainment industry.
Yeah, but that's sort of a bit, is they keep, for at least for a while, they keep bringing in like these big guest stars to kind of cycle in and replace this role for a little while.
Yeah, like Will Ferrell.
Yeah. Well, you could argue that Star Wars does that, right? That Luke is the main character for three movies, and then there's three other movies where other people are the leads, and then there's three movies after that where it's, you know, another cast of characters. And I think that would be an entire episode to argue whether or not it worked. Yeah, Star Trek. That's true. That's a little different.
Replaces the entire cast, you know, from franchise to franchise or iteration to iteration. So,
right. Yeah, going from generations into First Contact. Yeah, you've got an entirely different cast. That's true. And that worked. I mean, they got, how many movies did they get out of the next gen? Four, five.
Four.
You got Generations, First Contact, Insurrection, and Nemesis before they rebooted.
Yeah.
So four. So yeah, it's happened. But yeah, it's definitely not something that is easy. Clearly, you know, and even with James Bond, you know, like Sean Connery left, and then they brought him back. They're like, they realized you can't just replace the Connery, I guess.
Well, they brought him back for one movie.
Right.
That was sort of out of continuity, like kind of a what if scenario.
Yeah, but still like audiences pretty clearly, and I actually love On Her Majesty's Secret Service, but audiences clearly were not happy with the change.
No, you know, they weren't feeling the Lazenby. Lazenby fever.
I don't know that was George Lazenby's fault necessarily. Like, I don't think that blame should go on to him, but I think audiences just weren't there. We're ready for it. So they brought Connery back, and then they moved on to somebody. Now, Roger Moore brought a little more charisma to that role than Lazenby did. I think that's fair to say, and fairly quickly made it his own. But like, they changed a lot more than just the actor. Whereas like On Her Majesty's Secret Service feels like a Sean Connery Bond movie that doesn't have Sean Connery in it. Whereas I think Live and Let Die is the first Roger Moore movie. That just feels like a totally different thing altogether.
Yeah.
Which I think they kind of realized. So yeah, I think just kind of going back to like starting to care about the characters, I didn't care about any of the characters coming out of the first one or the second one. In fact, the second one made me dislike them all. and then I think you're right, Skid. I think Benji's funny. Simon Pegg is a really compelling and sort of inviting actor. Mm-hmm. Like what I like about him as an actor is how easy he is to watch and relate to, and it's because of his mannerisms and the way that he talks. Yeah. Like he is, as you put it, the everyman. But one of the things that both of the previous Mission Impossible movies lacked, and why the everyman is so important, is because in one and two, there's nobody really there to be like astounded by what they're trying to do. Right? Like they talk about like, oh man, you can't go in there. That's really tough. Check this out. But then those are the same guys that figure out how to beat it. Mm-hmm. Whereas Simon Pegg is like, well, you're just going to die. You're going to get vaporized. Like that's how that ends, you know? And it's much more natural. And like his character actually believes that. Whereas you kind of get the sense that the other characters who are all like professional IMF agents, you know, like they kind of, there's a confidence that they'll get around it. Right. And so I think that is a really important element. And I think that makes it a lot easier for the audience to not just to connect to Benji, but then connect to all of the scenarios that are going on, which means connecting to the other characters better too. One of the things I think is really interesting is how the actors in this franchise, in large, like, they get really, really good actors to be a part of the different IMF teams, or, you know, good, popular, you know, really super talented people, and how few of them actually stick with the franchise. Like, there's Ethan and Luther in the first one. They come back for the second one. And then you basically, you pick up Benji, and then in the third one, and then you pick up Jeremy Renner in the fourth one, and then you pick up Ilsa in the fifth one. But think of all of the talented people that were a part of IMF teams leading up to that. In you had Thandie Newton in the second one. You had in the third one, you had Paula Patton. Or no, she wasn't. It was Maggie Q and John Rhys Davies. That's totally the wrong name.
Jonathan Rhys-Meyers.
Yeah. Who's great. I mean, that guy's amazing.
Yeah.
And yet he didn't come back. And then in the fourth one, you had Paula Patton and Jeremy Renner. And then in the fifth one, you really only added one character. But like that, like any movie that would star the people that didn't come back is a movie I'm interested in going to see because yeah. They're that good.
That's true.
You know, like,
although one second, I will not stand for your Emilio Estevez erasure. I will not stand for it.
I'll watch Young Guns all day long.
He's coming fresh off of Judgment Night. He was on the top of the world.
I'll watch Young Guns 2 all day long. I'll go that far.
I'm sorry. Please continue. Franchise
Fan Guys. That's fascinating to me. And I know, in doing a little bit of digging, you know, one of the things I found out is that Paula Patton was supposed to come back, that they wanted her to come back from the fourth one for the fifth one. But I think there was a scheduling conflict or something like that. So she just couldn't. And and Jeremy Renner had a conflict, which is why he's not in Rogue Nation. So, you know, I mean, obviously life can get in the way, I guess. But I think that's fascinating that they built this team up over time. And again, I mean, we were talking about this last episode about sort of listening to your instincts, because I will say, as talented as those people are and as effective as they are in the films themselves, I wasn't like coming off of 3 and 4 for the most part. I wasn't clamoring to see those characters again. And they grow on you. And the other thing that I think is really interesting is, Tom, what you were saying about Luther and how he's the character that has known, that knows Ethan the best, has known him the longest. But if you actually watch the movies, I think the first time they've ever met is in the first one.
Yeah.
Like, they don't know each other in that movie.
No.
And
they know
it's
of each other, but they've never met.
Right. And it's pretty clear in all the other movies that, like, it's not like they hang out. Like, Luther is, like, usually brought in at the last minute. He has probably spent more time with Benji than he has with Luther, because Luther's always off doing his own thing and then gets called in later. He's like not really a part of the main team usually. I mean,
they bring him in at the very last minute. They bring him in at the very last minute and Ghost Protocol just have a beer with Tom Cruise.
Yeah. Which was apparently an afterthought, because it was like, we should have some more connectivity to the... So let's bring in Luther, and he's in the one scene, and that is the first scene where they actually seem like they are friends,
right?
Yeah.
So I guess that scene sort of establishes that they do occasionally hang out, I guess. But then
when he's like, "You don't know Ethan." I don't know if it was that scene, but yeah, he talks about him like he's known him since they were in like grade school.
Right. And like, that's the, right. And we talked about this in one of the previous episodes, the scene where where Luther is talking to Ilsa and it's like, there's only two women he's ever loved. And it's like, really?
Yeah.
You know him that well.
Right. Yeah. They only know each other from work. Like, how many people that you work with, that you just work with, would you say that about if you're having a conversation?
And you only work together every 5 years.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Like, you're both contractors and you come together every 5 years. It's like, man, he's only loved two women. It's like, what?
Yeah. It's the first thing he told me. Yeah. Really real wears sharing. His heart on his sleeve, that guy. Yeah.
Ethan. Think, Ethan. Think of the greater good, please.
Yeah, you do that.
So do you relate to any character, Andy? Is there any character you would be really upset if they weren't in part seven?
Upset? No. No. I mean, I will say this. I kind of have the opposite, I think, of you, Tom, where largely because of the last two, I now do actually really like Ethan. The majority of that is Fallout, because Fallout is so much about Ethan and who he is to his core, and it's just so good that I come out of Fallout and I am really rooting for Ethan as a character, as opposed to, you know, the world not exploding. So and I think, you know, and the other characters have certainly grown on me. Like I'll put it this way too, like, and I would not make a case for like trying to replace any of the characters. I like Ilsa quite a bit. I don't know how you keep bringing her back in. Like, either she needs to just join the team because you want to keep bringing Rebecca Ferguson back, or you probably need to, like, she shouldn't be like right in the thick of the action the whole time, because I don't think that, and they do a really nice job of this. Like, her character is perfect for Rogue Nation, where you don't know what side she's on. But after that movie, you know what side she's on. Like, you understand her motivation. You may not know her mission, which you don't at first in Fallout. And that mission sort of puts them at odds. It does for a little bit, but you know that she's going to wind up kind of more or less joining the team for the finale. So, like, I'd really like the way they handle that character in Fallout, but I don't know that you can really kind of keep just repeating that. Like, oh, well, she shows up here. She's involved in from another agency on the same case again and again and again. So I think they need to find a way to sort of more organically make her a part of the franchise, so they don't have to keep sort of manufacturing reasons for her to come in. But I don't like particularly want to lose any of them. The team that's in Fallout, I think, is pretty great. Like, I wouldn't feel a need to replace them, but if you killed one of them off and that worked from a story and a character standpoint, it wouldn't end my world, but I think I'd feel it now just because I've spent so much time with them. You know, like, if they wound up killing Benji or Luther or even Jeremy Renner's character, and Jeremy Renner's character is the one I sort of connect with the least. But yeah, I think for me, it's Ethan's probably the main one. Skid, how about you?
Yeah. What about you,
yeah.
Skid?
Yeah. I'm kind of with you, Andy. I think in Fallout, yeah, you really get a sense of Ethan Hunt's dedication and why he puts himself through all these horrible things to, you know, protect people and do his job. And so, yeah, he becomes, I also got way more attached to him as a character in that last movie. So that would be a draw for me to come back for these next two movies. I'd be a little bummed if anybody just got bumped off except Jeremy Renner. I don't know if it's something about Jeremy Renner or if it's just bad luck for the roles that he's getting, but just for these big franchises, just people just seem to care about his characters the least. I don't know what it is, like Hawkeye, like nobody cares. But
he's getting his own television show, you know.
Well, okay, we'll see how that goes. So but I like him. Like, I like Jeremy Renner. I don't know what it is. I'm throwing it out there. But the one guy that I really relate to, honestly, not as a character, but is Henry Cavill, because he is, like me, and I just learned this pretty recently, a huge giant nerd. And he loves, like, tabletop gaming. And we're both huge fans of the Warhammer franchise. And we're, like, I think he does, like, miniature painting and everything for that. And he is a huge fan of Total War Warhammer 2, which is my favorite game, like, computer game ever. And they named a character after him in one of the DLCs because he loves the thing so much. So, like, the character is a complete monster. But I just love the fact that the super cool, like, anvil-jawed muscle man loves the super nerdy dwarf game that I also like.
Well, I was going to say that's the other thing you guys have in common. Like, I've seen you, like, reload the guns like he does in the bathroom fight scene. Like, boom, boom. Yeah, I mean, you're just...
Right. Yeah. I think he got that from me. I don't know how, but that's just what I do. Whenever I fight in the bathroom, that's my first move to show I'm in business.
Well, and honestly, you bring up a really a thing that we just sort of skirted around. We didn't talk about the characters of the villains at all, like which I think is kind of important because for me, Jim Phelps didn't really work all that well for me as a villain. Like I'm still not sure I totally buy that, like how he went bad and all that sort of stuff, which they don't really go into. Actually, the best explanation for it is in Fallout when Walker's talking about Ethan and planting the seed of him having gone bad, when he's given that, like, how long before a man like that has had enough? Like, that's that speech would have worked a lot better, or not worked better. It works great in Fallout, but it would have worked really well in the first Mission Impossible if anybody ever stopped to talk about Jim Phelps going bad. Mm-hmm. But so Jim Phelps doesn't really work for me great as a villain. Dougray Scott is just not in a good movie. Like everything is so over the top. He's over the top and doesn't hold any water for me. Mm-hmm. I did think that Philip Seymour Hoffman was pretty amazing. He was the first villain that like stuck with me afterwards. And I remember, because I think, Skid, I'm pretty sure you and I actually saw that together in New York.
We did.
And
we both
Yeah, that's right. And so we came out and we went and had some beers and we were talking about one of the things we were talking about was like how great Philip Seymour Hoffman was and how much gravitas he like. That was the first one where the villainy, not just the stakes, right, but like the villainy came through, and like you were like afraid because you just didn't want that guy to be able to continue being in the world because he was scary as hell.
Yeah.
And then the villain in 4 doesn't do that much. I love that guy's performances in the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo movies, the foreign versions.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, he plays Michael. He plays like the other lead, the other two leads in those. But
right.
But that villain doesn't leave much of an impression. And then Lane is great in 5 and 6, but. The thing that's interesting about 6 is that Lane is great. He's a really compelling villain, I think. But they bring in Walker, who is like who is essentially the muscle, right? But he's so much more than the muscle. Like that is by far my favorite Henry Cavill performance, and I like his performances generally. I think he's quite good, even in that bizarre Hellraiser movie he's in. Fun fact, he's in like Hellraiser 6 or something like that.
Oh, well, maybe we'll have to talk about that at some point.
Yeah. But yeah, like I love Walker too. So along with the franchise getting better, one of the things I think they have managed to improve is the villains too, which makes the stakes feel more real. Is that,
yeah.
Do you guys concur with that or do you disagree on any of those?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah. I love the thing I love about, the Philip Seymour Hoffman is they start off with kind of a flash forward to the middle of the movie with it's sort of kind of a Marathon Man villain moment with Philip Seymour Hoffman where they shoot ahead to like him kind of threatening Tom Cruise when you have no idea like what they're actually talking about. So, and it's a great, great scene. And they start the movie with it. This is like, they throw that at you right off the bat. And it establishes him immediately. It's just like, you despise him and you fear him right away. And you don't even know why. And that's great. And yeah, Lane, same thing. Like, he's awesome. And like, he's in chains. Like, for almost the entirety of Fallout. And he's still scary and cool. So, yeah. And Cavill's the best.
I was going to say pretty similar thing when part 3 starts, when you see how villainous he is, it reminds me of The Dark Knight where you're just like, oh, here we go. This is crazy. Mm-hmm. This villain is insane. It's kind of what I felt like with that. Cause it's even before it says Mission Impossible on the screen. It's like the very beginning, right? It's like a cold opening of Philip Seymour Hoffman being a crazy person. And then essentially you think he kills Ethan's wife.
Right.
Love that.
Yeah. No, and I think that was also important for Mission Impossible 3. And we talked about this, I think, in our first episode a little bit, how Mission Impossible 2 did really well at the box office, but it was also not embraced by the fans. And so I think Mission Impossible 3, for multiple reasons, one is narratively, of course, if it didn't work narratively, they shouldn't have done it. But I think opening with that opening instantly told people that were coming back sort of tentatively after Mission Impossible 2 that this was different, that they were,
yeah,
that they were pivoting and mm-hmm. it's time to pay attention.
Yeah, it's like boom, reset button, boom, right there.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And Mission Impossible 2 really is kind of the forgotten Mission Impossible in the franchise itself. Like, I think we talked about this too, but like in the last two films at least, they have a lot of callbacks to others, to other films, except for that one. And they don't really. And there might be one or two that are in there, but they're much more subtle. Was it Skid? Was it you that was like that said like, oh, when he's only loved two women, you're like, oh, sorry, Thandie Newton, you're out. Like,
yeah, erased from existence. I'm sorry, it never happened.
Thanks for listening to Franchise Fan Guys, Mission Impossible episode 4 of 5. Please write a review and give a 5-star rating wherever you listen to podcasts. Intro music by Tom Breifogel and John Harvey. To connect, visit FranchiseFanGuys.com, at FranchiseFanGuys on Instagram, and at GuysFranchise on Twitter.
Bye.
Bye.